This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
Thanks, Tina. And thanks to Terry Winters also for inviting me to speak and be part of this event and the exhibition, which I hope you will have time to look at if you haven't seen already. Harry Smith's String Figures. So let's take a look. This is a few of the string figures that are in the exhibition. There's one of the things that's kind of interesting. So I got to know about Harry Smith and about string figures from an event that was here a couple years ago that Sina organized. And I was invited sort of as somebody who works with string in that I study knot theory, and I had a chance to meet sort of an expert in the area of string figures, somebody who's written books about them and has taught with them extensively, and we kind of realized that we didn't have that much to talk about because string figures are always starting from a loop. And knot theory is, that's the zero element of knot theory. So that we didn't know how to really build on it, but a question came out of it, out of our conversations that stuck with me. And a couple years later, I guess, this spring, I saw a math paper that answered that question. And that's what I'd like to tell you about today. So let's take a look. Here's one that's on the wall back there. So string figures, right, they're made in time, right? They're not usually something that's mounted as beautifully like this on a board. And the process of making them is really like part of the fun, and they're a dynamic thing, right? So you sort of build them up, and as soon as you pull your fingers out, they fall apart, and this kind of going through that cycle is sort of part of the excitement of doing them. I can do one string figure, which maybe I'll try later, but since we have an expert in the audience and maybe others as well, I might refer to them. Anyway, once you do mount them like this, they become objects, and different things become apparent about them when they're static. Things like the pattern of the string figure and symmetries, or not, as the case may be. So one of the things about that one that is on the left that's kind of striking is this sort of eye on the upper right. And if you take a closer look at it, this is zoomed in, it's actually a familiar knot for working called a slip knot. So if you knit, this is like the first knot that you do when you're casting on, and it has a lot of other functions as well. Okay, so there are knots within string figures if you sort of look at some piece of a string figure. So let's keep that picture up here. So here's James Murphy, who's really glad was able to come. He's here. And he taught me what I know about string figures and was at this event a couple years ago. So James has been teaching in the New York high school system for many years. I guess you're retired from that now, but he was using string figures to teach mathematical thinking, and I'm going to say more about that in a second, but he had this question, actually. Yeah, let me say a little bit more about that, because it's kind of an amazing story. So this is a New York Times article from 1986, and one of his students from LaGuardia High School is showing a string figure, and there's a really nice comment from one of James Murphy's colleagues. So Keith Kaplan, another math teacher at LaGuardia, who learns about string figures from Murphy, said, in learning to manipulate string into specific patterns, students inadvertently learn systematic thinking. So it was kind of a like stealth mathematics using games, which is something that's now like is a very hot topic in education, to try and develop games as a way of teaching not only math but other subjects as well. And here he is in his classroom. This photo is taken by another one of his students, Robin Moore, and she documented a lot of the students in the class showing the string figures that they developed. So from what I understand, he would teach a basic system and then introduce the idea of really operations and how you can compose operations and find the backwards, you know, the inverse of an operation on a string figure and build up variation in that way. Couple more students. I've been teaching mathematics for about 8 years now at the college level, and a lot of the courses that you teach in math in college are services to other degrees, which means that students are required to take them, and you don't usually see this expression, so it's like, I mean, it's totally honest. Anyway, I love the blackboards too. Unfortunately, they got rid of blackboards in my department. I don't know why they do that. Mathematicians still prefer them. Anyway, so getting back to this question that Murphy asked. So he said he noticed that he could often find things that looked like a particular knot in a string figure, like the slip knot that I showed you. But he wanted to see if it was possible to actually tie in a string figure a granny knot. So that's the one on the upper slide there. Not to be confused with the square knot. So this image I took from another working context with knots from actually the Bureau of Navy Personnel Training Standards and Curriculum, the book on seamanship from 1944, and they say that talking about the reef knot, that the name is derived from its being used to tie reef points. When reefing a sail, it's most useful knot, a good knot for tying up things such as packages. It can also be used to bend the ends of two lines of equal size, etc. It doesn't jam. And then they say, a beginner may tie a granny knot instead of a square knot by having one end up and one end down through the bite. Bite is just a loop, a kink. The granny is considered an unseamanlike knot and will work loose under pull, all right? So I don't know how many of you are familiar with this, but a sad fact is that there's probably a lot of you here who are not tying your shoelaces correctly. So this was something that Sina, Terry, and I were commiserating over, that there's actually... Right, so you have a bow. It doesn't look exactly like that, right? You don't tie your shoelace with one overhand knot followed by another. The second one has a bow, so it's easy to undo. But the point is that when you tie that bow after doing your overhand, there's a choice about how you do it, whether you do the same turn as you did for the first overhand knot or you reverse the turn. One way gives you the granny knot, and the other gives you the square knot. And the Navy Bureau says, the granny knot is inferior. It will come undone more often. And you can actually, right, so don't worry, you can watch a video about how to tie this. And there's even a TED Talk that Terry sent us that is supposedly very popular about how to tie your shoelace properly. Right, so how would you know the difference between one of these knots and another, right? That's sort of the basic question for mathematics in knot theory. In physical knots, they have properties of how successful they are at doing their job. They also have some kind of geometric kinetic properties, and the fact that the granny knot is sort of looks a little sloppy there, it's not a coincidence. If you pull this ends of your lace, it'll sort of align with down the shoe. So that's one way you can distinguish one knot from another. But that's a very physical notion in the mathematical theory. What are we talking about? We're just talking about curves in space. So it's important that it's a closed loop arranged in three-dimensional space. And we'd like to calculate something about it that could tell us that if we have two of these, that they're really different objects. So that's sort of the basic question in mathematical knot theory. And over the years, it's maybe a 120-year-old discipline. Mathematicians have accumulated tables of knots that they have proved are distinct. So that's kind of a first thing, right? So how do you know intuitively it's clear when you've got a knot that can't be undone? But there are also magicians who sometimes magically pull things the right way and they come undone. The question is, how do you know that if you didn't spend long enough and you weren't clever enough, you could get one knot to either untie itself or reconfigure into another picture? This table, by the way, is from one of the, sort of the first American topologist, maybe the first topologist, because he spent his whole career studying the field of mathematics that studies geometric properties that don't depend on distance and metric quantities that are somehow more fundamental. Anyway, this is 1927, Alexander and Briggs. There, you might notice that there are no crossings indicated. It's just sort of a projection. That's because these are understood to have an over-under pattern as you go around the curve. Good, so this is kind of a basic question, right? What does it mean, though, for two knots to be equivalent? It means that there's a way to continuously deform, so without breaking the knot into the shape, exact shape of another knot. And we're allowed to stretch, right? We don't care about distances here. We just can't break or join any of the arcs. So here's a cartoon to show that these knots I've called K1 and K2 are actually the same. You might have guessed that there should be a relationship. There's each of them have three crossings, but let's see one way to show that. If you put a little bite or kink in that arc to the upper left, and it gets a little more complicated, but if you can see in this that you're passing a strand, the under strand to the upper left there gets slid behind the central crossing. Why would you do that? Well, if you continue sliding behind this last crossing, you end up with now a little bite or kink here, and you can untwist that, and you now have this shape which can be sort of massaged to look like the K2. This is the three crossing knot, or the trefoil. So that's an example of a continuous deformation. Right, so how would you ever come up with that? And do we have to study these drawings? This is kind of annoying. You think of mathematics as being computational and numerical. One of the kind of the essential ideas which has boiled it down from a three-dimensional problem to a two-dimensional problem came with another knot theorist just before Alexander, Kurt Redemeister. He showed that if you have an equivalence, you can capture it by a sequence of just three different moves that may be repeated many, many times, but only a finite number of times. They're now called the Redemeister moves in his honor. And in this, you might have seen there was a little bit of a similar move done at the very end in the beginning with this this little single crossing that was removed, that those are actually the same type of move a Rittmeister won. And this move where we take a strand and pass it behind or in front of a crossing, so that's something that involves three strands. That's the Rittmeister 3 move. And there's one more. Right, so here's the Rittmeister 1, and I've sort of isolated it. The point is that these are local moves. You are looking at a diagram of the knot. In just a small area, you're making a change, but everything outside that area is assumed to be fixed. So here's the Rittmeister 3, just in isolation. And then there's one more move you can do that you need involving two arcs. It's pretty clear, I mean, with these that nothing is changing, right? In the sense that you're not tearing anything. You're doing sort of these elementary moves, but they can be combined to give some surprising effect, okay? So how can you use this once you've boiled down this problem of really a three-dimensional, knots are a three-dimensional problem, to a problem of diagrams? Then you can start to calculate things, okay? So you look for properties, be it a number or a binary condition or something more sophisticated, maybe an algebraic expression or a more abstract form that doesn't change under each of these, okay? So this is good. You just have to check these three moves, and if it's preserved, if that property that you're studying, if that number stays the same under each of these moves, then you know it must be the case for any sequence of those moves. So it persists for all diagrams of that knot, and that's called an invariant. Okay, so that's what topologists and knot theorists are looking for. Some examples of invariants. Let's skip to the third one here, the number of components, right? We can study knots are typically one component, tangles, but you could have two components that may be linked. The number of those components is not going to change under any of these moves because you're not breaking or joining any strands. So that's kind of an obvious one. The crossing number is defined to be the minimum crossings that you need to present the diagram among all diagrams. That's going to be an invariant. There are others, unknotting number, how many times do you need, what's the fewest numbers of changes of a crossing from an over, under to an under, over, that takes the knot into a circle. And then there are more abstract things. I just wanted to give you a sense of how algebra comes in. More that we can study polynomials that calculate things about knots. We can study groups, which are sets of symmetries associated to a knot. And these are sort of, the last ones are the invariants that are coming up sort of today. I mean, Kovanov homology, that's sort of an active area of research, as are these other invariants. So the one that I want to tell you about in detail is this tricolorability. Okay, which is a weird property. I'll say a word about chirality. That's kind of interesting. If you take a particular diagram and you change all of the crossings, you get the mirror image of a knot. And it wasn't known for quite a while whether or not those were distinct. It's not all knots have distinct mirror images. Some of them, you can take the mirror image and then make a deformation and get it back to its original knot. So it sort of was able to pass through a mirror and come back. But other knots, like the trefoil, actually was the first one, I believe, to be shown that it's not, that it is chiral. So it has a distinct mirror image from itself. All right, so what's a tricolorability? When we're looking at a diagram of a knot, it's made up of arcs that are separated at crossings, right? And you'll notice that there's always three arcs in to a crossing. So the game here is you have three colors, and you're going to paint all of the arcs in a diagram of a knot. Okay, and this is an example for that knot that we had before. So I'm using blue, red, and yellow. And the condition is that at a crossing, I have to have one of each of the colors meeting together. Like in the left crossing, I have red, yellow, and blue. Red is the overcrossing. And then you look in the middle, yellow is the overcrossing, but I still have one of each color and so on. The other thing that we allow is that all the colors at a crossing are the same. Okay, so that's a possibility. That's also legal. But to make it interesting, we don't want to just use a single color for the whole knot. We say it's a tri-coloring of the diagram if we use at least two different colors. So here's the other diagram of the trefoil with a tri-coloring on it. And actually, those are the colors that are mapped to each other if you go through the deformation that I had up before. Right, so this is a string figure, right? This is a loop, a circle, or the unknot. It is not tricolorable because I have a diagram where there's no way I can use more than one color. I don't have any crossings to work with. So we know that the unknot is not tricolorable, and I'll show in a second that this is an invariant. So it means that if you find tricoloring of your diagram, then you really have a distinct knot that there's no way you could sort of tease it into an unknotted circle. So this is going to give us a handle on Murphy's question. We're going to look at a granny knot and try to find a coloring that tells us about all of the possible knots that could contain it. But just to say a word about how you... Oh, right, so these are the rules. Color each strand of a knot. Diagram, one of three colors. And at each crossing, the three incident arcs are either the same color or all different. At least two colors are used. And the way you prove it is that you check for each of the Rademeister moves that you can do this without disturbing a coloring. Okay, so if you have a coloring, well, on a single arc, it has some color, call it yellow. If I put a single twist in it, it still satisfies the condition that I have here, okay? So in this case, all the incident arcs have the same color. If I have two arcs that are in the Rademeister 2 move and they have different colors, let's say, if they have the same color, it will also be the case, like in Rademeister 1, they'll all have the same color, so that's okay. But if you had two colors, then as one passes over, it sort of creates a shadow, and we have to change the color on that underpassing arc, the blue one there. I'll leave this one for you to think about. It's a little more complicated, but it also, we can check, we always want to check at the ends that we haven't disturbed anything outside the knot. So if you look at least, you can verify that it's red, red, yellow, red, yellow, blue, and here also red, red, yellow, red, yellow, blue, okay? So, and that's all you need to do. That means that if a knot is, you have one diagram that's tricolorable, every other possible diagram you could obtain by continuous deformation will also have this property. All right. So what does this do for us? Let's go back to the question. Can you find one of these granny knots in a string figure? What's that asking? It's asking if I have this, some region like this, right, where I have that overhand with another overhand in this pattern, is it possible that I could close up the ends in some way, maybe complicated, more crossings outside, but so that it is a string figure. In other words, that it's something that Murphy or somebody could weave on their hands from a simple unknotted circle. Right, so what happens if we look at coloring this? What we can do is check that this is actually satisfies the tri-coloring rules. At each, in this case, at each crossing, I have one of each of the three colors. And if I look at outside this little area, right, they all have the same color, okay? Well, that means that whatever else is happening, I can, right, so if the knot contains a granny, then it's tricolorable, right? So just take everything that's outside and paint it yellow. That's going to, if there are crossings out there, then they satisfy the condition that at a crossing it has all the same colors. And then inside the region, I also am satisfying that condition, okay? And again, it doesn't matter if I chose yellow at the outset, right? The colors are just markers. Okay, so that actually, that answers the question, because we know that the unknot is not tricolorable, right? Every string figure begins with the unknot, so there's no way that by doing this continuous deformation you could get to this situation where suddenly it becomes tricolorable, all right? So no grannies in string figures. that's the answer. So it's kind of maybe a disappointment. Where did the question come from? James Murphy can show you some beautiful diagrams or photographs of string figures where he has granny knots. And the only issue is that there's always one strand that threads through the middle, or maybe two strands that pass through the middle. And that's not a granny knot. It has something else going on that's going to change the that's going to obstruct that tricolorability. But it's kind of amazing that you can find sort of things that look very knotted, and just by having some arcs passing through the middle, you're able to undo the entire knot. Okay. Right. So, where did this idea come from? I came across this in a dissertation. By a knot theorist from 1999, who proved a more general statement about an invariant called a determinant. And he showed that there's a division property that for the determinant of a tangle and those knots that it could sit in. Somebody recognized this very sort of much more elementary proof that doesn't use any of the of that theory of determinants, and that was Dan Silver. Okay, so I've tried to give you like a little piece of mathematics about knot theory. There's still like all these questions that people don't understand. I mean, just sticking with this presentation, it's not known, for instance, if you have a tangle that's made from two links, two components, whether or not you can have a granny knot. Like, this technique doesn't help you there. You could ask, can you have a square knot? That's actually something that from what I've told you, you could answer by looking at a square knot, which has just a slightly different pattern of crossings. Another question you could ask is, with this, we found that there was a slip knot. So what's with slip knots? Why is it that you can tie one of those, like in the figure that's on the wall? But that's like a, so that's, those are questions in this little territory. But then there are these bigger questions like, what's with the knot tables? I mean, what's a good measure of knottedness? We have these invariants, but, the more powerful the invariant, usually the harder it is to compute. Or sometimes we have very powerful invariants, but they don't tell us the geometric information that we might like to know about the order of knots in this table. So there's still a lot of mystery in these things. And one thing that I've been lucky to be able to do is find some artists who are interested in these kind of pictures as well. This sort of pictorial topology, this description came up when Terry and Sina and I were talking. And so I wanted to show you a little bit of those kind of problems, a different problem solving. This was a project with an artist, Peter Coffin. He's based in New York. And he had seen these knot tables and wanted to know, like he was always drawn to them, but he thought, you know, why is that one on the top, like, what's with the funny bug feature? Like, can you make it more symmetric, you know? And in fact, this led us to think, like, what is the most symmetric presentation of a knot, which is a sort of funny question to ask, because all we care about is the arrangement, right? We can flex this and twist it and turn it without changing the knot type, but still, it's, you might think that, for instance, the fact that this is symmetric bilaterally would tell you something about the knot. Actually, that is a kind of invariant. But he was interested in really, like, very fine, how could you control the geometry to make a three-dimensional rendering in neon? You can't see the crossings because of the light. There are no shadows. But we came up with this scheme that was kind of impressive in a way. Like, conceptually, we just in terms of producing these things, right? In order to control the neon, we needed to build a mold, basically. He tested out with some hand-made neon, but it didn't have enough tolerance. So we set up a kind of parametric design studio and then built some wooden forms that were based on computer-designed sort of roller coasters. So these were all parameters that he could control, and he made about three, and that was about as much as he could afford because they were extremely expensive. Another project that was a lot messier but kind of more fun because of that was with Brian McConnell. He had found a photograph that intrigued him. So the title of the photograph, it comes from Library of Congress, is the title of the piece, and it says Sergeant C.M. Battleship of Sydney, Australia. That's actually his name, Battleship. Leader of RAF Royal Air Force attack hitch destroyed 6 Junker 52s and damaged others at the El Aden airdrome. Examining one of the telephone wires which was draped from the oil cooler's wireless masts, tail and rudder of his plane when he returned to the base. So he would fly low and cut lines. And this kind of absurd question came out of it, like, could you make that from the photograph, that bundle? So we mapped out the photo as best we could. There were some areas where there were 3 crossings we couldn't resolve. But then we took that drawing and we laced it through with a thin wire, and then we followed that with a thicker wire, and he made this silver-plated tangle that's on the pedestal, which was used to make photographs. So it was kind of the whole process was knotted and folded. And then a more recent project, so actually all 3 of these artists were shown in the exhibition that Helena Coppola and I organized this summer. Alan Glatter has been making drawings with a 19th century parlor sort of entertainment device called a harmonograph, which is a table that has 2 pendulums attached to it. One pendulum swings in one direction, and then there's another pendulum attached to a stylus that swings perpendicular to it. This is a little bit like a spirograph, if you had one of those. But it produces these sine waves that interact depending on how you release the pendula or how long each one is. And he's attached a Sumier ink roller to make these drawings, which he's then been making sculpture from. So the path of the drawing happens in time, and he's been sort of extending that in a Z direction. These were also shown at the Dumbo Arts Fair recently this summer. And that brings us to Terry's works, which I've been curious and fascinated by for some time. I've Haven't met Terry before this presentation, so I'm looking forward to speaking with him about some of the images that come in and disappear and move through his paintings. So I wanted to show some of his work as well. We can come back to these. These are recent paintings, and there's one more. So I'll stop there. Yeah, so I only say it at the end, but you can interrupt me with questions if you have any. Yeah.
On the tricolor
thing.
There's the art too.
Yeah.
It seems like there was an under that seems kind of discontinuous with what you were talking about in terms of the overlapping.
What's
that?
In
right, the art two there where it's going underneath but it's getting a different color.
Yeah.
Changing.
Exactly. Yeah, right. If it didn't change color, so do you agree on the left that it obeys these tricoloring? I mean, from what you can see anyway, there are two colors. There are two colors that are being used. We need to have at least two colors. And oh yeah, maybe that would help. And then over here, right? So if I had left that as yellow, then I wouldn't meet the condition at a vertex or at a crossing that I have three different colors meeting or all the same color. So the coloring is really a coloring of a diagram, which is not the same as if you had taken string and colored parts of it and then moved it around, where the coloring would stay the same, presumably, when you moved one strand like that yellow under. The game is really, after you make some move, if you have a new diagram, can you show that that still admits a tricoloring?
But on the right-hand side,
yeah.
It changes color when it goes underneath something, or I guess, I'm trying to understand how that, the right-hand side.
In this one, you mean? In this one?
In
this one?
In this guy over here?
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, it's strange, right? This coloring is not of the strands. Like, I have a strand that goes from top right down to bottom right. But it does have different colors. I'm only coloring the arcs. Yeah?
Every crossing colors. Every time it crosses, it changes color. So on the left side of the R2, it doesn't cross. On the right side, it does cross. Whenever it slides past itself and no longer crosses, the colors revert to their pristine shape. Every time we have a cross everywhere, it changes colors, except in the R1 on the right, when it's quite clear that that's the same.
Yeah, that's a great point, right?
But on the R3, why does on the very bottom of the right one, why does it not change to blue at the bottom instead of red? On the R3 to the gray.
Yep.
Bottom. That red to the right.
This one here.
But it doesn't have the blue or some other color.
Below the bottom one. The bottom one.
That one there. Yeah. Below the
bottom.
On the right or this one down here?
Yeah.
Ah, okay. So I think the question maybe is like, what's the dynamic when you change a crossing? Are you allowed to change the color of that strand that moves through? And the calculus says that's fine. It doesn't really care. All it cares about is that I didn't change anything outside the picture, right? I didn't change any of the coloring outside the picture. And that inside, before and after, I have some coloring. It could be quite different that meets the criteria. That at each crossing you have three or different or all the same. But yeah, it would be fun, I mean, to see like a movie as you make a deformation, right? Things would be changing colors by these rules as you went along. Yeah.
Any other questions so far? We can come back to them.
Well,
so,
fast question here. Did I hear you correctly saying that loops are the zero element of dots?
Yeah. Right, and I didn't take any time to describe an arithmetic, but you can sort of multiply knots by making a cut in each of the two knots and taking the two free ends and joining them, sort of splicing them, and that's considered a sort of product operation. And it's not too hard maybe to picture that if you took an unknot, just a circle, and you cut a hole in it, you get an arc that if you attach to any knot isn't going to change the knot. So in that sense, it functions like a zero element in that any number, you can add zero to it without changing that number. Unfortunately, though, you don't have a subtraction. Like, it would be nice if I took one of Sina's poorly tied shoelaces and I could like tie another knot and splice it in to make it untie magically. That doesn't happen. So it's a different kind of arithmetic. But
you can add other kinds of knots to each other and add to their complexity.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, the granny knot, if you look at it, it's exactly one of these products of the three crossing knot. I have three crossings. If I closed up these ends at the bottom and top, I would have the product of two of these three crossing knots that I started with. And the difference between the granny and the square knot is whether you add two of the same type of three crossing or you add one to its reflection. Anyway, I'm saying more than that.
Well, we can do, can we get some people's to come up with their shoelaces and we can do it?
We should.
So maybe that's a good segue for us to have a little talk about Terry's work in relation to knot theory, but also the knot tables in some sense, because only today when Philip was kind of looking at the knot tables and putting them right next to your work, did the fact that your work is in some sense about ties and topology and their various kinds of, the ways in which they can fall apart and open up. That's one strand of it, but also the knot table is actually kind of very strongly there in some of the work, or seemed to us at the time. Is that something that you have looked at or studied or sort of what kind of resonance do these knot tables have?
Only in the sense of them having a relationship to or a reference to some idea about the modernist grid or a presentation about factual information. And I mean, Philip, you know, it's a great discussion and talk about the function and the uses of knots or topology. In a certain sense, I'm interested in the abuses of it and how the abuses can help sort of enrich the mystery that he was also referring to and possibly open up a kind of imaginative dimension inside of pictorial space, since pictorial space is also composed in some sense out of geometries. And just to explore and to play with that notion about manipulating formal elements in order to generate a kind of pictorial space. So it doesn't come out of any connection to their functionality.
Right. But is it often the case that it's about a knot, and then it's the various ways in which it can be transformed into other things, that, you know, the way the knots were being moved through these kinds of operations?
Well, that's the hope, that it's transformed into something that becomes, in some sense, a picture or a painted picture that has a resonance that's more metaphorical or poetic in some sense.
To what extent do you look at the math of it as opposed to look at the figure and just, you know?
Almost in no sense. in a nonsense way. Uh-huh. That, you know, it interests me in terms of the kinds of resonances that can be brought to bear on it, but it's really how it functions inside a painting and references painting itself, that, and one's reading of the possible meanings of the pictorial spaces that get generated, that interests me. Mm. Not in any kind of application of some knowledge.
What brought you to Knott's? What were you doing?
Curiosity.
No. I mean, what was the? What was other?
Can you break? Can you tell us what Terrace made it so we can?
Now, I'm just wondering, what were the things you were looking at pictorially before you started to look at knots?
Well, I just other kinds of geometric mathematical models and structures, some idea about a technical imagery and how technical imagery can function as a kind of mediated idea about nature itself, and that somehow, in the same way that, you know, Cézanne described that painting should generate a new optics of nature, that somehow we now inhabit a kind of wider idea about what nature is, and I think it can include also this idea about technical images and scientific exploration as part of this notion of a wider nature. Mm-hmm. That painting can somehow open up or develop some other sorts of hidden meanings or connections, expose some sort of connections in there. And in a way, I mean, just as Philip was talking about the unknot, or how the circle is the beginning that can be morphed and manipulated into any number of geometric configurations or pictorial or poetic associations, I think that the sort of the rectangle of painted space also ends up being manipulated by any kind of mark that happens inside of that space, and that's always been the condition of painting, and I think there's also some idea about how can painting still extend that activity and open up these other sorts of imaginative spaces.
Mm. Did you have any other?
One of the things that, looking at them, yeah, I mean, I don't know, maybe not many people, when they look at your paintings, they see specific knots, but because I can recognize some of the features of tables, they
are there any grannies?
There probably aren't, because usually the knot tables, they factor out those kinds of product knots that are combinations of simpler ones. So there probably aren't any grannies, but there might be. I haven't searched them through, but my eye is always like trying to figure out the detail of which one and counting crossings. And I like the things that obscure that information, whether it's another knot interfering with one or the coloring of the regions. It sort of forces metaphors in thinking about math that I don't think about. And at first it was sort of frustrating, but then, like, once I got over the fact that I can't read them, that they're like letters or characters that have been you know, written over or some kind of palimpsest, like, then.
Yeah, I mean, there's some sense that they're jamming the information in order to spark some other kind of pictorial association. I mean, I'm very taken with the figural or facial readings that these things take on, because I think that they're constructed from the same forces that the world is formed from. So in some indirect sense, I'm trying to generate other kinds of pictures out of the same means and materials.
Yeah, I think that's funny, because, like I was saying before, with a knot table, there's no particular configuration that's preferable within some, you know, reasonability. There are choices that every mathematician who made a diagram had to make, and somehow topological.
Right, how to draw them?
Yeah, I mean, the specifics of the shape and the different regions that are cut out and how balanced they are, and unfortunately, we've kind of been stuck with the same table. People don't redraw them. Some graduate students for Rolfson, somebody can correct me if I'm wrong about this, but this knot theorist wrote a famous book, and he had some of his students make these drawings that were redrawings of earlier ones, but people haven't, you know, really spent much time thinking about other presentations that might inform, you know, might be a better table in terms of understanding them. And
I'm not sure this would be a better table.
But there is always like something psychological about looking at topological drawings, because they become these sort of Rorschach things that, with loops and holes and handles and, or maybe I.
No. There's some. Yes.
I should say I've been writing about Terry's paintings, so I've been sort of thinking about this question of the referentiality of the mathematical images, so that you look at them and say you're familiar even personally with the knot table, and you see, okay, these are those knots. And
is this
doing anything?
Is that doing
anything?
Yeah.
It's the
cordless,
yeah. The light
is
lit.
Is there a gadget to turn it on?
It's on. Maybe it's over there.
No, it just went on. It just
there it now it's on. Okay. So what I wanted to say is that you have this referentiality to the table of knots, and you have the fact that they have been effaced by what looks like some kind of a drama, that these figures are both referential to the world of knots, and they're subjected to some kind of a drama, as if it were possible for mathematical spaces to enter into a concrete world and take place in some kind of an agon in relationship to what's happening in that world. And that in itself is a very interesting reference point, because in a certain sense, that's our world. Our world is one in which, if you study the mathematics exists in its own world. It's in its own Platonic universe of pure forms and pure relations. And yet, we know that world is something that takes place in our world. So there's a sense in which the paintings are dramatizations of that situation. So it's not just, okay, they're interesting knot figures and we can have Rorschach relationships to those images. It's that, yeah, we have those relationships to those images, and they're referenced to the mathematical world. And that creates a relationship to our whole circumstance and the position of mathematics in that circumstance.
Whoever else would like to.
No.
Thoughts?
Could you flip through the other paintings?
Yeah.
Things that change, the thing we were just speaking to. A string figure is nothing, but it is actually a four-dimensional vector equivalent through time, so that it is absolutely different, but it is merely a four-dimensional vector. It is changed through the flexing of the torus on itself.
Thank you.
So I'm glad I didn't try to do that. Disaster.
That's a good point to end.
Can I see more? Can we see some more of that action?
Yeah. Sure. By popular demand, Murphy, we'd like one more demonstration. Maybe you should take a seat in the front row.
I'll do a variant of that figure I just made. That was an Eskimo Inuit figure called fishnet. And because it was a web, it can be permuted. This is the first of the weaves. I will turn this over on itself and do the inverse of the weave. And the inverse doesn't erase itself because I have turned it over. And I will do the same thing again. Uh-oh. I don't want to do that show. Start over. Let's see. I didn't practice. You have to practice thinking and talking at the same time. I'll do it quick. Weave, inverse. Roll, two, three. Weave, inverse. Like watching water run down, yeah. Roll. Two, three. And I have to keep count, because if I do it wrong, y'all are going to laugh at me. Because it won't work. When I taught math doing string figures, one of the things that the students quickly realized was that you couldn't get 85 on a string figure. It worked or it didn't work. Mm-hmm. I don't want to tempt myself to go further because this string is not quite that long. And I end up doing the same figure from the beginning. But you see that I get these little stars. And it really is a function of frustrating that inverse relationship by rotating the figure on itself. Again, this is nothing but a four-dimensional vector equivalent. It's stuck there now because I did all of the things pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing in, so that this is the resultant. And in order to take it apart, I have to unravel it.
But by the torus, you meant the string itself.
Yes. Yeah. That's all it ever is.
Yeah. I mean, in the Inuit context, what is it? People watch it being done. Is it a temporal event in that sense?
Every culture has string figures. And the modern culture, it is children's game as a vestigial. But in 1902, when they figured out how to do an accurate hands dance so that they could go see the people who still did them, the illiterate people, American Indians, African tribesmen, South African, or African people, Australian Aborigines, who did string figures in their full glory, they were able to collect 1,000 or so, 2,000, I don't know, do you remember? Something like that. But that's about all we have left. But what I did was try to figure out how to play with it, because that's essentially what people used to do. And I found that my students, I had to beat them in the head not to practice too much, but they would become able to do it correctly every time, which is what you want in a math class. Yeah. And they were then able to be talked to intelligently about the procedure that they would have to do so that they could do that with anything that they wanted to learn.
Another example that he was illustrating is on. Another thing that he was illustrating right there is untangling. So that was an unknot, but it was tangled. And it was non-trivial. You saw him working there, untangling it. Mm-hmm. And so far, I believe it.
My students learned patience.
Yes, but I believe
they always had to untangle before they could do another. Yeah.
And as far as I know, it's still an unsolved problem of finding an algorithm for untangling any tangle.
Even an unknot.
No. Thinking of untangling an unknot. Mm-hmm. Something you know is an unknot. So therefore, in theory, it can be untangled, but to have a canonical way of doing it, in other words, it's not known.
Uh-huh. Is there a mathematics of the entropy of tangles, of hanger tangles, why things get tangled so amazingly rapidly?
Yeah.
You put a bunch of strings in a pocket and it's tangled.
Philip, weren't you working on an untangleable set of headphones?
Oh yeah, I had a patent idea, but No, I guess yeah. Some people have done experiments actually where they've taken lengths of string and put them in basically a washing machine. And repeated this thousands of times, and then photographed the result, and using some invariance, distinguished which knots come up somehow the most frequently. I know in that context, I mean that's a much more physical understanding of knots, but
spontaneous generation of knots.
Yeah, exactly.
Sort of actually formal identified knots, not tangles.
Yeah, right. So. I mean, it turns out that the three-crossing knot, as you might expect, is the most common, and then the four-crossing is the second most common. Actually, beyond that, they're pretty rare to find. I'm always looking for them, like in extension cords and things like that. Like, I usually stop and look.
Are they just show up more frequently than others?
Yeah, the smaller ones, they're the most frequent, which sort of makes sense. You just need a bite that then a strand passes through to... But I know that that study was motivated a lot by a real life and death problem with the umbilical cords becoming knotted during pregnancy, and that is still a very risky situation when usually they do a C-section for that. But if they knew the ideas to understand how that happens, why it happens, or how frequently.
Would it be like assignments of probability to, degrees of distance from the original situation.
That's right.
Probability of given knots occurring.
Yeah, I don't know that there are any proofs in it. Yeah. I think it's experimental evidence, but maybe other people here know about that.
If you ever go to LA at the Great Machine Project, which is a nonprofit there, they have this weekly competition. They inherited, someone gave them to this nonprofit, a drying machine. And they have this machine in there, but instead of doing their clothes in there, they put tons of Ethernet cords in there, and they let it go, and then they take the tangle out, and then they have a competition. They give like four or five tangles to various people, and they have to sit there and do this, and the winner gets something, I don't know what.
But
it's kind of astonishing looking how...
The invariant would be some kind of the circular movement.
The what?
Some kind of circular movement. Of the drying machine that's tumbling in
there. It is. Yeah, and so I don't know if that means that the knots are more complex or less complex than they could be if you had multiple movements. Or
yeah, well, it would probably be more identifiable, even though it's a mess.
It looks complicated, but. Dave, do you have anything else?
I'm going to be loud. I'm sure a very elementary question. But it's not until toward the end, Philip, that you mentioned the splice.
Uh-huh.
And is there a rule for seeing a form and being able to identify whether or not it requires a splice? Even a trefoil requires a splice, right?
No, I guess the trefoil is a prime knot. It isn't composed of simpler knots that have been joined by that splice move. So the question is, if I give you some tangle, is there some thing you can calculate about it that tells you that it's prime? And there are different invariants like that, but it's a hard question in general to show. So there are some invariants that carry really that algebraic information, like I described a Jones polynomial, so some algebraic expression that you can calculate about a knot, and it turns out that product knots have structures that are products within that polynomial and others. So you can sometimes work out from that if the knot is a composite or it's somehow prime.
Winters, where do you see this going next in your work?
Just in terms of expanding on the kinds of source material I've been playing with and trying to continue to wrestle some sort of traction, pictorial traction out of the technical imagery.
Could you put that first painting back, the one that was... No, the other one? Yeah. It really seems to me that does explore what you were talking about, the drama. The first two lines, to me, read very much as masks, sort of, or faces, insects. And then the third line is very much occluded. And then in the last line, you come back to the structure, the mathematical structure seems the...
Yeah, well, so it's about using the painting process as a visualization system to open up those sorts of abstract narratives.
Right.
But it can't be described, or the trajectory of it can't really be articulated outside the act of creating the system of the painting itself for me.
It also reminds me of the Hebrew alphabet kind of coming alive. And
well, there's a connection between this notion of, you know, mark making and how drawing and writing are in some way synonymous and linked as a system of generating meaning, since they're and how gesture and touch also affect the way that meaning is somehow inflected. In its own reading, and through the changes of materiality that happen inside of painting itself, that you're not reading only information; you're reading the information through a constructed object.
I had a question for Philip about the if you had ever drawn a knot where you start with the space between the string.
Oh, right, these like sort of windows.
That have a space, yeah, that grows until you see the line.
Uh-huh.
Because yeah, I'm just struck by these, how you didn't take your brush and just draw lines. Mm-hmm. It's sort of... almost looks like a screen or something. You're looking through. You see the red through the blue or something.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really good point. So I emphasize the arcs and the strands and maybe even this kind of sort of craft beginning of the subject in thinking about building tables of these drawings and what are the sort of best shapes. But probably the reason that people, I mean, that, yeah, so there's like an Ashley's Book of Knots is sort of the reference for making practical knots, this book from like 19th century, and it says on the back something like, back from a time when when knots put food on the table, and but actually, I mean, why do I get paid to do research in knots? Is really because we understand more about three-dimensional space by looking at problems with knots. So the first construction that I saw about this is kind of amazing thing that Bill Thurston did, where he studied knots from a different perspective by taking volumes like solids and identifying their faces and doing this in a topological way, gluing things together and stretching them, and was able to construct spaces that are the complements of knots. So the filling out of the volume around the abstract curve in space. And that has been an extremely fruitful area of research. So even though people do really study the combinatorics and this pictorial topology of diagrams, like the reason that, I mean, it's such an active area of research is because it draws on the volumes and on, I mean, one of the most powerful invariants is this thing called the fundamental group, and it measures the way different paths through the space, different loops that start at a base and maybe thread through these windows and come back, that the symmetries of that space is actually determines knots. It's just hard to calculate.
I just wonder if you could talk about Harry Smith's relationship to the string figures.
I have my own mic. My relation to them only has to do with a fascination about the figures themselves, and the fact that through a series of correspondences, I came across a collection of them and had an opportunity through these correspondences and coincidences was able to get together this collection and show them here with Sina. It's not as if I'm trying to demarcate any sort of direct link that I feel my work has to them. It's more about a fascination with this notion that these very handmade and simple objects that are so widespread in terms of their occurrence across so many different kinds of cultures have a capacity through these very simple means to generate very complex pictorial pictures and stories, really, which is what, for me, more and more I see painting as, of like a very simple, childlike means of expression, almost a kind of folk art in this culture to sort of address more complicated and less corporal imagery that we're always surrounded with.
Has anybody read Barry's 1,000-page manuscript?
And have it, some pages.
No, I see, but I saw they were mostly just lists of things. Are there texts? Did he write about, for instance, the ceremonial use of string figures in different cultures?
I only know the pages there, which is about 100 pages.
They're mostly held and not allowed to be seen.
Really?
International String Figure Association has been very politely asking that question for a long time, and I've been frustrated.
Well, we were in touch with the Getty Archive, which holds that manuscript. Was there a sense that some parts were removed?
Well, but you know, those were the only pages that so far had been scanned and have sort of not officially totally available. But now that the Getty has officially acquired the archive recently, perhaps I think there's an ambition that things will be cataloged and scanned and made available. But it was those things were held in limbo, I think, in terms of where the ownership was and how to disperse it.
I have a question.
Yeah.
About Rye.
We're recording it, so.
Oh, okay.
Thank you. Phil?
Mm-hmm.
Is it on? Yeah, okay. There's these other mathematicians who have talked about a knot, and they posit that for a given circumference of the string, if you will, mm-hmm. as it shrinks down, there is a writhe which occurs in the way that the knot wraps around itself, and that that is a very, very interesting mathematical function of the knot. And do you know anything about this? Because I have been trying to figure it out, and I don't have much of a clue.
You're talking about a knot that has some thickness to it.
Yeah, and there's a twist as it shrinks on itself.
Oh, okay. I don't know anything about that. I know, I mean, the writhe does come into calculations with some of these invariants, but there it's actually not an invariant. It's just a sum of crossings.
I will send you what I have gathered so that you can understand what I'm talking about.
One place to look at, I know there was a really great article in an issue of Cabinet, interview with Ken Millett, and he works on more of these physical properties. I mean, he does a whole range of studies in knot theory, but I know that they were doing tests for, this is something I never thought of, like where a knot is likely to break if it's under strain, which is...
Pasta, I think.
Right? Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so...
It would take a long pasta...
Cooked.
Is this the one you think Cook pasta and then knot it in lots of ways, attach the two ends to these machines that would then slowly pull and see where exactly in this complex knot it would give up.
With a high-speed camera.
Videos are amazing.
So that has bearing on your question, because where the tension is you know, loaded onto the strand when it's pulling is going to affect where it breaks. That was how I understood it.
There is a ratio of 4/3, which is an invariant when they do that.
Of that twisting. Yeah, I don't know about that.
I don't understand it, which is what I'm asking.
Question?
I just had a little question. You said you were going to explain how we use the word topographical wrong or topology. I'm not sure what the word is.
Oh, that's the confusion, basically.
Right.
So they come from the same word, topography and topology. They both come from the word for place. And topography is the study of landscape. And topology is this branch of mathematics that concerns geometric properties that don't depend on distance or angle. So things like connectedness or how many components a link has, these are notions that don't change if you stretch or even if you make a cut and you glue things back according to some to preserve the local structure. Yeah, so topology is kind of a field of weird examples. Like, so the Mobius band is one of these things so the number of sides that a surface has, whether it's two-sided or one-sided, is a topological property. And what does it mean to have one side? It just means that there's some path on the surface that takes you from one side to the other side without passing over any edge or falling off, right? So that doesn't change whether you make a long Mobius band or you make a short one. Maybe the thing that characterizes it, actually in an article that Terry gave me, there was a really nice description of the that in math you're always studying sort of symmetry of one kind or another. You're trying to find correspondences between parts, very generally described, and topology is interested in invariants, those things that stay the same under what seem like not geometric operations but have geometric information, stretching and continuous deformation. I don't know if that helped.
And then this French theory's version of topology.
Yeah, so it's been picked up in a lot of different contexts because it offers a new way to think about mathematics. And there are a lot of really good stories about things getting turned upside down in how people thought about geometry with non-Euclidean geometry And those were serious dramas in the history of math. What impact they have for the psychology of the self, you know, it's I don't know, I don't understand. But if you read Lacan, you can read about knot theory.
So this is really a question about the string figures, but what survives about the significance of the string figures for the people who made them? What sort of information is available about those?
What's the significance of string figures for those who made them?
Yeah.
Maybe James can say more.
There's not much left. And I feel that it's a pale shadow of what was. I don't know. And I don't think anyone does. Pre-literate activity is not recorded.
But, you know, in the film program that we put together for the exhibition, there's a short film of a Navajo grandmother explaining some string figures to her grandson. And I think that in some sense, some of the figures operated in order to explicate and describe different kinds of mythological structures, relationships of the tribe or the clan to the landscape, or talk about ancestors, or just be a kind of way to socialize kids in a way, or define elements between people in the tribes. There's a lot of work done in the turn of this 20th century by Franz Boas, who documented a lot of the kind of narratives associated with so many of the figures themselves. And I think that's part of what their power is, even without knowing specific stories, they do contain some of that sort of narrative quality, even through their formal elements.
Does 2030 have any language quality? I mean, quipus are knots that have linguistic function, right? I just wonder, is there any mathematical study of quipus, possible relationship between properties of the knot and language meanings, tendencies, structures?
Yeah, maybe there are people here who've been following this more recently. I know that I read an article 2 years ago that saying that some anthropologists thought that they had decoded one place name through a quipu by looking at the knots along the strands. My little understanding of it is that's where you have one arc with many strands that are coming off of it, and then those strands are knotted. And from the description I've heard is that there's a kind of a geographic spatial relationship that I don't know if it's families or dynasties that are recorded of, or it's actually geography that's arranged. But as far as I know, people still don't know how to decode the knots along the strand. There's only about 600 of them, so there isn't that much data for them. Peter.
Hi. So it was interesting earlier when Mr. Murphy was talking about these being vectors, four-dimensional vectors. And so we've talked a lot about three-dimensional space and then two-dimensional space, diagrammatic or pictorial. And I'm sort of asking Terry, how do you see the function of time, or the fourth dimension in your work, and how it relates to the imagery?
Well, that's how the imagery unfolds. And that's, I think, a very important element of the painting process, is that they are being built over time. And in some sense, they're a kind of architecture of time and a pictorial record of their own making, and that the ultimate emergence of the final image itself is somehow a kind of surprise that happens over the course of time through their construction. And just as the materiality of them is important, the time it takes to build them is important. And I think that's also what's beautiful about seeing the demonstration of the figures here by Mr. Murphy, that all of these things are happening over time and the complexities of building right before our eyes. And although the kind of metrics of the string figures are very much predetermined, I guess I'm interested in the way that paintings are not predetermined and not measurable in the same way and occur in a space that isn't so easily unpacked or explained. And that part of the process of looking at the paintings is that that traction or tension that happens between trying to unravel the possible meanings that are encoded in the paintings.
Peter, you had a question?
Yeah, it's a kind of historical curiosity. I just started wondering, like, at what point did knots become like a specific mathematical object of study?
It was, so about 115 years ago, I think. The story goes that Lord Kelvin had a theory about matter that instead, in place of atoms or sort of the atomic element. So this was at a time when there was still prevailing belief that light and was propagated through a medium the way sound is. So there was this idea that we had an ether that pervaded all of space, and that's what light propagated through. And so there was a theory that the ether on a microscopic scale was formed into little vortices spinning around themselves. And he reasoned that this could happen in different ways, and depending on how these vortices were knotted, you got different elements with different properties. That was his theory. So he set to work. Actually, he asked a Scottish mathematician, Tate, to make a table of different elements based on just knotted paths. That theory fell by the wayside with the Michelson-Morley experiment that showed that there is no ether because it doesn't matter which direction you propagate light. You can show that you can remove that assumption, but nevertheless, the tables and all the mathematical questions that came out, they survived. And I mean, there were conjectures that Tate stated that took almost the whole 20th century to resolve. So that was sort of where it started. Yeah.
Actually, it's completely returned. In this month's Scientific America, where they're talking about the possible prions that are smaller than quarks and the relationship between the prions and space and time itself, the actual images that are being worked with are knots. So I'm sure knot theory is working at that level too. I mean, right now, just theoretically, not. It's not like they've got all that together, but
yeah.
It's still going on.
In the interview with Ken Millett in Cabinet, he actually discusses this. He talks about various kinds of genetic materials and other kinds of things being knotted, and how knot theory could actually help unentangle some of these things in particular ways. Any last one or two questions? No other questions here? Okay, you have it again.
Yeah, this is really dumb because I can't remember either the name of the author or the peoples that they're talking about. But it's in one of the Aranos, that set of six Aranos books from the Bollingen Foundation. And it's an account of the migration of souls through the afterlife, and it has a relationship to the particular, not exactly shamans, but something like that, that has to make these complicated knot-like figures in the sand at a certain point in the itinerary of the of the of the of the dead, and whether or not the person is able to make the knot in the right form has an effect on the actual transmigration of the spirit. So it seems to me that there's got to be lots of that kind of a material buried in our lost memories.
No other questions. Maybe can we end with one demonstration of the shoelace and the granny knot and the better knot?
Oh yeah, yeah. Should
would somebody like to somebody who has their shoelaces always come undone during the day would like some help? They come up and we can fix it here. No one has this problem. No one has a problem. I certainly do. David, do you have this problem?
Well, he was studying, not serious.
I know, he's studying. I'm going to put my foot up here and have Philip teach me. This is what I do, Philip. If you want to get up, you want to learn, you're welcome to. I go like this. This comes under here.
Left over right, right over left.
This goes like this, this goes like this. This goes on top of that, so under.
All right, I gotta get out my laces to see.
Is that a granny knot?
Well, the test that we learned, right, is if you pull the ends here, if it lines up after you pull them with the laces, then it's a granny knot.
So it lines up.
See how it's sort of turned in this orientation?
Yes. Now it's lined up.
Yeah, that's no good.
That's no good. That's a granny knot. Okay. So, what I could have done, the same opening move.
Yeah, same opening move, right.
Down here, I do this still exactly the same way, and I then go this way.
Exactly, yep.
That's all it is.
That's all it is. Yeah, it's as simple as that. Well, let's see. Is it going to have the same...
Why is that so much better? Wow.
So that. If you pull...
If I pull this...
Did you hear that? It feels... No, that's not a topological property. So if you pull the side, it stays horizontal.
If it stays horizontal, when you pull it,
yeah.
You're in the top part, the bottom part.
No, the top part, actually, yeah.
Top part?
Yep. So if we go back... Oh, there it is. Yeah, see how this is like this sort of direction that's supposed to be the telltale sign. But yeah, I was thinking about like why does it turn? If you look at these strands, like this is the only difference, right? The granny knot and the square knot is see how you have both ends of the square knot or reef knot, they're coming out on the same side of this bite or loop. Here one is coming in behind and one is coming in front. And I think that makes this strand, this is not what I study, so I'm just like, I'm just guessing. But I was thinking about why does it turn, and I think it's because this strand here can fall into this space here, whereas these strands are pinned by the opposing loops. I think that's why it stays more stable. And once that strand starts to fall in the middle, then there's room for it to move. That's my professional opinion.
Thank you. Was it? So if there are no more questions, please join me in thanking Philip and Charlie.